podcast is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Jerry never took a bad shot. I don't remember him shooting a bad shot. He shot it when he wanted to, when he's ready. We'd get him the ball, and we had centers that couldn't shoot a lick, but they could set good picks. And they'd come out and set a pick for him, and he'd rub his man off on them, on the big guys. And the big guys would switch off on him. And, well, he'd just buckle their knees. I mean, he'd lower his shoulder, and like he was going always to basket, take one hard dribble, and he'd go up and just rip it. Never expected him to miss a shot.
Jim King is a retired NBA player and former college coach. A 6'2 guard from the University of Tulsa, King was selected by the Los Angeles Lakers in the second round of the 1963 NBA draft. King played 10 NBA seasons from 1963 to 1973 with four teams, the Lakers, the San Francisco Warriors, the Cincinnati Royals, and the Chicago Bulls. He represented the Warriors in the 1968 NBA All-Star Game, and he retired with 4,377 career points. King later coached the Tulsa Golden Hurricane from 1975 to midway through the 79-80 season, when he resigned after 4.5 years. The school retired his jersey number, 24, and in 1984 he was inducted into the University of Tulsa Hall of Fame. Hey Hoopheads, this November our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are offering $3,000 off the CT, the best shooting machine in the world, and you can also get $1,000 off their home machine. Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. You can also check out their holiday gift guide to make shopping for the hooper in your life as easy as can be.
Hi, this is Coach Jay Smith from the University of Michigan, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its play bank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Prepare to hear some great stories from NBA history with former NBA player Jim King. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, but I am pleased to be joined by former NBA player Jim King. Jim, welcome to the Hoopheads pod. Excited to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all of the interesting things that you've been able to accomplish in your basketball career.
Thank you, Mike. I'm really looking forward to visiting with you.
Let's start out by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about how you got into the game of basketball and what some of your earliest memories are of the game.
Well, you know, I was raised on a farm in Arkansas, a dairy farm, and so, and I remember not having electricity. So we were really poor. There were five of us kids at that time. Later, there was one more. But, you know, we my brother and I had a goal from the time we were five or six, seven. You know, but we never had a net or even thought about it. And there were no leagues to play in because we're so far out in the country. And so I liked sports so bad. I mean, really, really well on baseball, probably more than anything, because it was easier to get someone to play when he was in school anyway. But in a small town, too, you know, about 300 people in the town. But in a really, really small town. So anyway, you know, I never really got fired up about basketball. It was mainly just about baseball. And then when I was in the sixth grade, I had a brother that was older than me that was 13 months older. So we were like twins and very competitive with each other. And we moved to Fort Smith, which was 35 miles out. My dad had decided he wasn't going to be able to make a farm life. And he went into Fort Smith and found started working for Coca-Cola. And so he had to be up there. You know, at the time we didn't even have a car. We had the church bus. So on Sundays we at least could go to church because he drove the church bus and he took care of it. So anyway, he had to finally get a car, and then he worked for about a year or two like that. And then when the sixth grade, middle of the year, my parents said, well, we're going to move to Fort Smith. Dad's found a house up there and we're going to buy that. And it's got an acre and you'll be able to take your dogs and animals. And we ended up taking a cow too. I had to milk that cow all through my high school days. And you know, that was something because I had these really big hands already. And, you know, palming the ball was simple. I could palm it out of the air, really. And kind of like Oscar Robertson used to do me, he'd come, you know, dribbling right at me, and he'd have his hand on top of the ball, but he could move it to the right or the left. And officials never called, you know, any kind of carrying the ball, and even though he carried it. And I learned to do that too. So, but anyway, there was a boys club in Fort Smith, and we got to go in there and try out for baseball. And they did a draft, and you know, you got drafted on different teams, or one team. My brother was on one, and I was on another. But we were so country, and you know, my dad would bring Coca-Cola, you know, just at the house, and we'd take all the lids and play baseball with those lids. And we could hit, you know, we could hit and throw. And when we tried out there, my brother was he was older, 1 year. So he was, on the older age, but we, you know, I went out for shortstop and he wanted to pitch. And, so I could throw so hard that they said, son, they kept asking me when my birthday was. They thought I was, you know, 2 or 3 years older, I guess. And I would throw it to first base when they'd hit me ground ball, you know, and then they finally said, son, could you just not throw quite so hard to the first baseman? He doesn't have a real thick glove and he's not having to be able to catch it. So anyway, you know, we were so green, you know, but yet we were so excited to be in town where we could actually play sports. And, baseball that first year was our first. We just absolutely thought we had died and gone to heaven. And then at the end of the year, when winter came, well, I went out to boys club and got on a team, played, basketball. And I loved that too. I mean, I really loved playing basketball, but I, you know, hadn't had any coaching at all, but we played one-on-one all the time. So that was my beginning. And then, I went to a junior high school and in the eighth grade, it was a new one. It was built real close to my house. So I went there and there was, in the eighth grade, I was like the best player on the team. And I, you know, I could tell I was, I could tell I could do everything better than the coach basically told me that, you know. And I played 1 year of football and I hated that, standing out there and froze to death, you know, and then I was a quarterback because I could throw the ball, but that's the first game I had ever played in or even really, I'd only seen part of one game. So I didn't know anything about football, but I thought the football coach was also the basketball coach. So I was smart enough to know that I better get to know him and he wanted me to come out. So I ran one play in seventh grade in football. He put me in the last game of the season, and we stood out there, and it was about 20 degrees. And we played Muskogee, Oklahoma, and they had big kids over there. And in fact, several of them went to OU and played football after they went to high school there. And so there was some great athletes. But I went in, he said, I want you to run this play. And I went in and I said, throw it as hard as you can. And he said, well, try to get it down there where that guy can get it, maybe in the end zone. But I went back and threw it. And just as I threw it, this big lineman stepped on my toe. And I was standing there freezing the whole night. And I lost my toenail because of it. And on the way home, I decided I was not going to be a football player anymore. So I retired from football on the way home from that game and didn't get mixed up with it at all. So then I went out for basketball there and played for him. And we weren't that good, but, you know, I played in the eighth grade. I played in a 100-pound tournament. So that was a size, just to give you an idea of my size. I weighed 103 pounds, so I had to lose 3 pounds to get in that tournament. So they went by weight. And so I got to play in that tournament. But then, you know, he didn't know anything about basketball. He was only about 5'6". He was a Golden Glove fighter and really, you know, one of those guys who – he had a cigarette hanging out of his mouth most of the time. And if you went and talked to him, you know, you'd be choking on smoke. And, you know, that was before anybody thought anything was wrong with smoking, I guess. And my dad even smoked at that time. But anyway, you know, when I finally got to the high school, actually high school wasn't until 10th grade. I played in 8th grade, and then in high school I went to 9th grade first. And I played, but the coach that there were the other junior high school moved over and became the assistant coach for the high school. And they had about 4 or 5 guys on the team, and they were – so they came, and he was coaching them as a JV coach, and I was on that team, you know. So, but he wouldn't play me because he knew his other players, and he wanted to play them. And even though one of them was more of a football player than a basketball player, he wouldn't even play me in front of him, or, you know. And anyway, it was a very frustrating time. And I remember coming home one night, and my mother was she had 6 kids. She knew all of us well, and I came in one evening, and we'd had a game, and I said I may as well just quit, and I told her what was going on, and she said — she was standing at the kitchen sink washing dishes, and she didn't even look up. She just said, well, if it's too tough for you, maybe you should quit. And, you know, she knew how to motivate me because she knew then what she had done to me, you know, and I did too. And I thought, you know, don't tell me I'm not motivated. Of course, I never said that. But anyway, I went back out. And then this is really during my sophomore year. And I was on the JV team, during the course of the season, when I got that real frustrated with the other coach, I realized he's not going to play me. The head coach, he was an incredible coach and a man, and he won the state in Arkansas. He won the state championship with girls and boys, and I know he won the boys were 6 times, and he never had a losing season in his 50 years of coaching. He was a great teacher, and he came to me. He could, I guess, he really read that I was really getting confused, but he also saw that I had some ability, And he said, son, I want you to suit up for the varsity from now on. We're going to go on a couple trips too. So he said, you need to just plan on doing that. And I thought, man, you know, that was all I needed, just a little bit of encouragement. And still didn't get to play much, but, you know, we were winning most of the time. So he'd put me in at the end of the game. So this is the side deal here. My dad had he used to cut my book. There were four of us boys and two girls, and he cut our hair all the time at home. And I started cutting my brother's hair because we hated his haircuts. He'd like a bowl, you know, clippers would get hot, and then he'd skin us up the sides, you know, white walls on the sides. And we hated that, but, you know, we didn't dare. He didn't allow anybody to talk back to him, you know, or even give you a suggestion. But anyway, so I got to where I could cut his hair. Then he had an uncle that was a barber in this little town, and he passed away, and my dad got his barber stuff, and he brought it home, and had a chair and mirrors and, you know, everything. Had a little building out behind like a garage, and we put that stuff, all that stuff in there, and I set it up before I could cut the boy's hair, or my brother's hair. He said, you know, you need to go ahead and go to barber college and get your where you can go to work. You'll have something you can fall back on. And I thought, oh, that'd be fun. I mean, it'd just be fun to get out of town, you know?
Right.
I mean, we lived in a four-room, actually two-bedroom house with a sleeping porch on the very back. And that's where the four boys slept and left, you know, lived basically. World champion games were played back there with oatmeal boxes hanging from over the door going into the kitchen. And we could play with a tennis ball or a jack ball or whatever ball we could find, you know. And but there would be a knockdown drag out every game. So I went to barber college, and we had some neighbors that had moved to Oklahoma City, and that's where I had to go to get my license. And it would take me 6 months. So I went over there in the summer, and it's first summer, and thinking I'll play some baseball over there because I know they have a lot of great baseball. And I got over there, and they wouldn't let me play because my parents didn't come, you know, didn't live there. So I went to the, you know, it kind of ruined my whole year, but I did go to the gym some and shoot. I wasn't playing a lot as a sophomore. So this, I'm coming back and to my junior year, and I started playing some. I was like the second or third substitute on the team, and I was about 6 foot. 5'11", maybe. And I had those big hands again, my huge hands, you know, and I could go up and get a one-handed rebound and stuff like that. But I was coachable. I was so coachable. I mean, if he wanted a timeout, he wouldn't ever yell. He was a real quiet guy, but he would stand up and put one finger in the palm of his other hand. And that meant timeout. And there's five guys called timeout when he did that, because we all had one eye on him all the time, just because he was so tough and strict, and, you know, he didn't want to have to raise his voice or holler or to say anything. And then we'd come over and lay down in front of him, right, a semicircle. He wouldn't even get up. He'd just sit there on the bench and talk to us, and we'd be belly down, we lay down on our stomachs and in a semicircle, and he would draw something out or show us or tell us what he wanted. And so that's when I started kind of getting serious about it. But we went to our junior season. We only lost two or three games, and we were in the state. We got really better every game, and they got to the state tournament, and we had to play some, you know, Texarkana was the one our conference, and they had a big 6'9" guy, went to Rice. And we played them first and beat them, but 10 or 15. And we were very, we played Iba style, Mr. Iba. He would say, I want everybody to touch the ball before you shoot. That meant, you passed it, everybody got to touch it once, and then you start thinking about shooting. And it just, he was very conservative. And we didn't do any fast breaking. There was no fast breaking gun. Although we had the talent to do it, we had two, we had this center that was made All-American as a junior. He was 6'6" and was our leading scorer. And he only had sight in one eye. And he led the nation in free throw shooting all the way through his college days at Arkansas. Tommy Boyer. And wow. That year we won the state championship. Went right to the, and we played Central. We had to play in Little Rock. And Little Rock Central was always a competitive team for us. And they were waiting on us. And we, at the end of the first quarter, there were 8 minute quarters. Tommy Boyer had 6 points and somebody else had two. So we had them 8-0 at the end of the first quarter. And they thought they would never get to touch the ball, I think, because every time they got it, they thought they had to shoot it, so it just played right into our hands and my coach's hands. And so we go ahead and beat and win the championship. Well, then that next summer, I had to go back to another summer at Barber College because I needed 1,000 hours and I had to do 6 months of that. So I went back the day school's out. I went back to Oklahoma City and stayed until the day of started back at my senior year started that day. We start, first day of school. Anyway, but what I did that summer was I would leave the boys of the barber college at 2 o'clock after I'd get there at 7 and I'd cut hair until one. And then I'd go into class and we had an hour class. And then I'd go to the YMCA. And I, at that time, there would usually nobody would be in the gym. And I would go up and I'd lift weights like we did the sixth hour or seventh hour at school. And I would do those weights over and over again. And I didn't have any idea if I was growing or how much I weighed or anything. And then when I came, that summer, I really improved, and I grew 2 inches and didn't even know it till I got back home. But I also put 15 pounds on. And so basketball really got under my skin there after we won that state, because that was really fun to be the best in the state and thinking we could come back and do it again the next year. So my senior year, the big thing I wanted to do was find, get a start, be a starter and play a lot. So when I came back, first thing I heard was, that was the year of the integration problems were going on in Little Rock. The governor Faubus closed all the schools in Little Rock and said, you can go to school anywhere you want to go without any penalties. But not in Little Rock. So they said, some kid said, have you seen the new kid on campus? He moved up here from Little Rock. And he said his grandparents lived in Fort Smith. And so he moved up there to get his senior year. And he was 6'6" and weighed about 220. And we already had the center who was an All-American at 6'6". And then we had the two guards who had played since their sophomore years. They'd been starters. And then that other spot was, there was a kid that played in front of me in my junior year. And I thought, well, that means I don't get to start again. So I go to practice. And what I don't realize is I am physically ahead, so far ahead of him, the kid that was ahead of me before. He was he made a doctor. He's an eye doctor. Okay. But he was going to school. He was smart, and he wasn't practicing or going to the gym. He was just going to school and getting ready for med schools and all that stuff, you know, college. And I walked in the gym that first day and we did some drills and stuff. And I thought, I am stronger than he is. I'm quicker than he is. I'm faster than he is. I'm just better. And I thought, I can make this starting team. And for the first 6 weeks of our season, I led the team in rebounding, and the most I ever scored was 13 points, because we averaged about 51 points a game, and we held our opponents to 31. So, you know, there wasn't a lot of shooting. Like I said, there weren't any running. I would have loved to have been running some, but he didn't. He didn't, and he knew that, but he just knew I wouldn't, you know, I wanted to, but I was loyal to him and did what he said, you know, kind of like my dad. If you can't hear it real good, I'll get the belt and get your attention. You know, if you can't listen, we'll teach you how. And so that's the way my coach was. He got my attention too. So I started playing and I was just much better than I thought I could be. You know, I just didn't know. I out-rebounded those two other guys, those big guys, most of the year. And then it came down, and we won the state again. We lost one game by 1 point, and that we beat them like 30 the next time we played them. You know, it was just one of those things when we went on the road and you couldn't win again, couldn't do anything right, I guess. But anyway, we lost that one game. We thought we could have gotten it. You know, had an undefeated season, but we didn't. But we did win the state again. And after the summer, and during the summer, my coach called me in and said, he said, I've been thinking about it. He said, how would you like to play in the All-State game? You know, they have an All-State game for basketball and football and some other sports now, baseball. He said, how would you like to play? And I thought, you know, all the press had ever written about really was the two big guys. And I said, what about, he said, they've given me said I could pick my own two players to come. And I want you to go. And I said, what about, you know, Larry? And what about Tommy? And he said, well, Tommy's going and you need to go. And he said, you've earned it. I want you to go. So I said, man, okay. Well, I didn't even have a jump shot. I mean, I didn't score that much. I got most of my stuff off the board, tip ins and, you know, just rebound putbacks and stuff like that. I didn't shoot anything outside. So, you know, nobody knew what I could do. But as far as handling the ball, I could handle it as well as the guards. I could pass it. You know, I had all the skills because of that coach. He made us do everything, both hands, right and left, and do them full speed. And if you couldn't, he'd say, you go down at the other end of the floor and learn how to do it. And then you can come back up here and play with the big boys. You know, he'd just kind of rub that in your face if you couldn't do it. But he wasn't going to wait on you. You know, so he was very strict in that area. So you end up being able to do that. Everybody on the team could do it. I mean, it didn't matter how big you were. You had to do the same drills that the guards had to do.
Right.
You know, and you had to do them right. You had to do them left and right and full speed. And he was an incredible coach. And I didn't realize how good he was, you know, until later. But when I got down to the All-Star game, you know, I got practice for 5 days. Then we had the game, or 6 days. So they started playing me. They saw that I could handle the ball. Nobody knew I could handle the ball. And they said, you know, we think we're going to play you at guard. And I said, great. I can play guard. And he said, well, which one you'd rather play? And I said, the open spot. Put me in the open place. I don't care. I can play center if you need it. And I just felt that confident. And they said, well, we're going to put you at guard. And I said, okay. And I had been working for that summer. I started working on a jump shot, so I at least kind of know how to shoot one. And we played that game, and it was like 4 minutes or 5 minutes to go. They called timeout, and they selected so they could announce at the end of the game the most valuable player. And at that time, I was tied 16 points, and then another guy had 16 on the other team, and it looked like, and they had a 4-point lead on us, and so they gave him the most valuable player. They selected him, you know, before the game was over, and in the last 4 minutes, I kind of just took over, and scored like 6 more points, and you know, was doing all my other stuff, and I was hitting jump shots that I didn't even know I could shoot from, you know, out. One time I thought, I got up in the air and thought, I've never shot one this far out.
All of a sudden I'm a guard, right, Jim?
And my guard, and they were going in, you know, and I never had anything like that. So anyway, I ended up, when they announced the most valuable player, people stood and for about 5 minutes, they just stood there and booed, you know, because they felt like I should have had it. And, you know, I didn't really care. I was so happy. I didn't care about the award, really. I just was thrilled that Tulsa University had come after me, and they wanted Tommy Boyer too. But he wanted to go to Arkansas. So all he ever wanted to do was go to Arkansas. So, and I did too, but, Tulsa was there. And then at the end of the game, my coach came down, and I was on the court talking to family or somebody, and he came up, walked up behind me, and he said, "Hey," he said, "you still want to go up on the hill?" And he said, and I said, "No, I've already committed to Tulsa." And that was before if you said it, you meant it. You know, you couldn't change it, or I guess you could, but I was taught that you didn't do that. And I just said, "No, I'm not. I already told Tulsa I'm going there." And he said, "Good." He said, "There'd been a change of heart. The coach up there was Glenn Rose. He was an older guy. He kept telling my coach, he said, you know, he's too small. He's not big enough to play inside, or he's too small and he's too slow. He doesn't have the speed he needs to play guard in our league." And he said, "Well, he's going to be playing at the University of Tulsa, which is the Missouri Valley Conference, and I think that's tougher than Southwest Conference. So if you don't get him, you know, you're going to lose a good one." And he didn't. He wanted me to come there, but I just wouldn't do it. I couldn't. And you know, and my coach said, "You know what? You made the right decision," because he said, "Missouri Valley Conference is the number one college conference, puts more people in the NBA than anybody else in the country." So, you know, Oscar had just gone in there, or he was, you know, Cincinnati was winning the national champion. And anyway, they were tough then. And so that's kind of, you know, from there, I was ready to go to college and play. And that's what my coach said. He said, "Well, you'll be able to run the ball over there." He said, "They like to get it down." He said, "I've been talking to the coach, and he said he wants to get you over there and get you running up down the game." And that coach over there was not a great coach. He wasn't a great teacher, but he was good for me. He told me, "Son," he always said I was, you know, I was like a son to him. And he said, "Son, if you think you can do something, I don't even want you to think about not doing it. You go ahead and do anything you want to. I believe in you that much. I want you to do anything that you think you can do." And so that freed me up. You know, I needed that kind of confidence builder from him, to know that he wasn't going to be like my other coach and, you know, screw us down real tight. But anyway, that was a chance to go to Tulsa. And then I got to see all the Missouri Valley teams, you know, in freshman ball, you don't get to play them. But in those days,
yeah, different time.
Yeah. And I, my freshman year, I think I averaged like 20 a game. And I just thought, this is the easiest thing I've ever done. You know, you know, I've never seen anything so easy. But it was because I had the ability to do it. I just was afraid to, you know, to really turn loose and show them what I could do. And anyway, that's where I really got started right there. And when I got to Tulsa, we played great basketball. And Tommy Boyer, I see him all the time, and he's always talking about, you know, the best thing you ever did was go to Tulsa. He said they were the best conference in the country, and it made you better. You know, you got to play great guys every night you played, and that prepared you for the pros. So he didn't play pro ball. He's a multimillionaire, but he was a business student and really smart, good guy. Still living up here in Fayetteville. He's on all the boards up there, athletic board and the academic boards and everything.
Really, really good man.
What did you want to do when you went to school? What did you think you were going to do career-wise?
I thought I was going to be come back and be a Joe Dean. You remember Joe Dean? You know who he is? He used to coach at LSU.
Yes.
Joe Dean used to work for Converse, and he would come up, you know, and he told me, he said, you know, when you get through playing, you need to come back here in Oklahoma, and we'll put you here as a rep for Converse. And it'll be, you'll get to be with basketball and be well with these coaches all the time, and said, it'll be great. You'll love it. And that's what I planned on doing. But then when I got my barber license, you know, I had this barber license, and I'd set up shop in the dorm. And that's when, you know, I could charge 50 cents a head. And I was only getting $15 a month, you know.
yep.
For the money, for the laundry money, but I could go in there and set up shop and work for an hour, or say an hour and a half, and the guys would sit, you know, they'd fight for spots, and then I'd get, make $20, and man, that's a lot of money. I had money all the time. You know, I sent my brother money. He was at College of the Ozarks, my older brother, and playing ball over there. And my folks didn't have any money to send them, you know. So I did that a few times. So the other ones sent me to school at Barber College. So, you know, I felt like I needed to help them too. So anyway, I don't know from there. You know, when I got ready to go to the pros, the Lakers drafted me, and I didn't, you know, there was no, it wasn't even on TV. You know, it wasn't even, I don't guess it's even on the radio, but
it's probably on a chalkboard, right?
Yeah, that's about it. And what happened was, there's pretty interesting stories on that end of it. So they called a coach, and my coach said, Lakers are trying to get a hold of you. You need to come over here and we'll call them. So I did. And Lou Mose was the general manager, and he's a rough, tough old guy. And he said, I'm going to be coming in there tomorrow, and I'll meet with you and give you a contract. And he came in, and he had a $500 check, bonus check. And he had a $9,500 contract for the rest of the year. And, I said, okay. I said, now I want a no cut contract. And he said, we don't do contracts like that. He said, coach doesn't like them, and we don't like them either. You know, so there is, we don't do that. You'll be all right. He said, if you just make the team, I'm here to do what you think you can do. And I said, I can play defense, and I can, And he said, well, all we need is we need somebody that can cover the offside guard from Jerry, so Jerry West doesn't have to. We don't want to wear him out playing defense. And he said, if you can do that, you can make the, you might be able to make the team. And then he said, and if you can get the ball down the court and get it to Jerry West or Elgin Baylor, you will make the team. And I said, okay, I can do both of those things. But I said, I want you to give me time to show you what I can do. And he said, you'll get your time. He was a really grouchy old man. Anyway, so I'll go out. They said, you have to come in August. Well, I had that $500 bonus. We were going to get married after my first year, and the Vietnam was going crazy, you know. And they were, if you got out of college and you were single, you got drafted. And so after I got out there, he said, we'd like to get you to go ahead and get married. If you could do it, we go ahead and get married so we don't lose you to the Army. And he said, I said, well, I can do that. I'm sure I can get that to happen in a couple of weeks. And I called her and told her that. She said, well, I can't do 2 weeks. Might do three, you know, and get it done. So I flew through on the first road trip to Tulsa and stopped in Tulsa, got my blood shot, all the stuff you have to do before you get married, and got the license. And then I went on to New York, picked and cooked and stayed, you know, with them for a road trip. And then I flew back through Tulsa, got married, and took her with me. And she'd never been past Oklahoma City, and got her out of LA. She hated it out there. But anyway, that's the way I started it. And but here's what I was going to tell you about. That we had training camp, we had that tryout camp, and they had eight guys there, and five of them were drafted, and the other three had been on some other teams before, and they wanted to work out, you know, wanted to try out, so they let them come in, and so we were working out the first day, and I got there at 9 o'clock in the morning. I didn't start till 10, and they. So I was there actually at 8 and waited 2 hours for them to open up so I could get in. I hadn't met anybody other than a general manager, and I didn't know where Loyola was, until I found it on. And I wasn't even sure that I was at the right gym or anything, so I was nervous about it. But I was finally, somebody drove up in a car there by this gym where I was staying or waiting on them. And he was an older guy, and then gets out of the car. And I said, is this where the Lakers work out? And he said, yes, it is, son. And I said, well, are you with the Lakers? And he said, yes, I'm the coach. And I said, oh, well, I'm Jimmy King from Tulsa. And he said, oh, Jimmy, nice to see you. And the first time he'd met, he didn't even know what I looked like. You know, you'd think he'd seen some film or something.
Right.
You know, and that worried me. So I thought I'm going to be the, you know, first one here and get in the gym and first and you know, I'm going to be ready and I'll be the last one to leave. I was just so gung ho. So we go in and I go in and get dressed and get on the court, shoot for a while, you know, get ready for everything. And he coached Jerry West, you know, Fred Shouse. He coached Jerry West at West Virginia. And he played some in the pros. He's a big guy, about 6'8". And was a good man. But he was, the good thing about it was he had coached in college, so he was a teacher. He was more of a teacher. And then some of these guys who turn in from pro to coaching, they don't really have any technical, you know, teaching ability, and that's more, it's probably not as bad as it used to be, but that's the way it was a lot. And so I'm in there working, and he says we're going to go, tells everybody we're going to go a 1 hour, and then we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and go another hour. And about 15 minutes into it, Roger Strickland was the number one draft pick. He was a 6'5 guard, led the nation in scoring 2 years in a row from Jacksonville. When I was checking in a motel, he was in line, and I was in line. I knew he was, 6'5". I thought, well, he's got to be with the team here. So I said, are you here with the Lakers? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, I'm Jim King from Tulsa. He said, no, he's Roger Strickland. And we just said hello, and he was kind of tight-lipped, so we didn't talk much. But what time did you get in? And he said, oh, I've been here 30 days working out with the regular team. And I thought, what I had asked him to do, I'd called him and told him I'm on drive out my 55 Ford that doesn't have any air conditioning. And I'd like to get, if I could get in out there at least one day ahead of, so I could kind of rest up. And the old man said, hell no, you get here when everybody else gets here. And, then I found out that, and I wanted to whip somebody, I didn't know who, but it was, he'd lied to me, about the practice stuff and all that. So anyway, I just thought, I don't have time to think about it now, but I'm in practice. We're in practice first hour, and they opened the side windows. There's no air conditioning, and we were having a smog alert. That was 63. So there was a lot of smog then. And I couldn't see. Nobody could get a deep breath. It was awful. When they opened those windows, the smog, you could see the smog just rolling in. And then everybody was just dying, about 15 minutes into the practice, this guy, Roger Strickland, they had brought him out there so they could check him out and see if he was as good as he's supposed to be. And they actually figured out that he couldn't play, and he couldn't cover my mother. He was awful defensively and didn't ever even thought about a defense. All he did was shoot. A standing shooter. And about 15 minutes into practice, coach said something to him. I don't even know what he said. And he turned and he said, son, there's the door right over there. Turn your stuff in. You're through. He was gone. So there were seven instead of eight.
Wow.
Yeah. That opened. I liked that, because I like discipline. I like to see them be in charge and if they got a bad mouth, we'll get rid of them. So that encouraged me. And so most of them couldn't run the drills that he was running. I mean, they had run in, they'd throw the balls away. They'd crash and run into each other. It was just, hadn't been coached. Most of them are from smaller schools, and they just hadn't been coached much. And hadn't had many drills. What happened was he got really frustrated because the guys couldn't run the plays. But he saw I could run the plays. And he looked at it, he said, Jimmy, you know how to run this play, this drill? And he told me what it was. I said, yes, sir. He said, well, lead us out. So I did it. And then from then on, I let him out. I got, that moved me up to the front of the line, because he saw I'd been coached. And then when the hour time came, he called everybody in, all seven of us in, and we're standing in a circle on the court. And he says, all right, take 5 minutes, get a drink of water, and we're going right back after it. And everybody, all seven, six guys, laid down on the floor in a circle. They were hurting. Everybody was hurting. I was hurting.
Right.
And couldn't get a breath for a long time. I mean, it was just really, your lungs were killing you. And so what I did, I thought, I never had a coach that would let me sit down and practice, let alone lay down on the floor. That neither my high school or college coaches, they were tough guys. And so what happened was I ran down to the other end of the floor and picked up a ball and worked on my ball handling, shot a few free throws, did a little tapping, just stayed busy. And then when they got ready to go, I didn't even get a drink of water because that's something we never did either, you know. And I just went right back to work. And so the last day, I mean, then we go on an exhibition and play 10 exhibition games. And you know, we travel around and all that. And they're eliminating guys all the time. So it's down to me and the guy from North Carolina, Eastern Carolina or something. He was a standing jump shooter too, one of those guys who really couldn't handle a ball, run a break or anything. But he was a nice kid. Anyway, so we get down after we played those games, he called me in and he said, the old man did, he said, well, we'd like to keep you if you could move your wedding date up and get, so we don't want to lose you to the military because you're going to be out there, you know, suspect for it. So we said, we don't want to lose you. You think you could do that? And I said, yes, sir, I can do that. I can get that done. And he said, okay. And then he sat there for a minute and I kind of looked over his glasses. He says, I guess you know when you made this team. And I looked at him. I said, I played 10 games, part of 10 games. And I thought, what did they see? You know? And he said, well, you remember that first day of practice when we had that smog alert? And I said, oh, yeah, I remember that. And he said, remember what you did? You're the only one didn't lay down on the floor. You ran the other end of the floor. He said, well, your buddy Jerry West, and I had never met Jerry, but he said, your buddy Jerry West was sitting with me watching practice. And whenever you did that, he leaned over to me and said, there's only one guy here can make us better, that kid right there. And I thought, holy cow.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
That's a powerful story.
And he said, you know, like this, like I've always been told, you do the right things and the right things come back. But you got to do them first.
Looking to grow your coaching? United Basketball Plus has over 3,000 plays and 45 deep dive courses with some of the best minds in the game, including Tyler Costin, Paul Kelleher, Tobin Anderson, Dave Love, and more. You can also view their United Basketball clinics and receive 50% off in-person clinics. United Basketball Plus has partnered with Jordan and Joe's Decision for their skill development curriculum. United Basketball Plus is a one-stop shop to help you grow as a coach, leader, and culture builder. Follow the link in the show notes and use the code CLINIC to receive an annual membership for just $50.
Later on, I'm on the All-Star game, I think I forgot, and the owner was Bob Short, who owned the Lakers at that time from Minneapolis, but he's the one that moved them to L.A. And he says, Jimmy, and he speaks. I realized who he was. He said, we talked to him, and he says, anybody ever tell you how you got drafted? And I didn't know what he was talking about. And I said, no, I don't think so. I don't think I've heard anything about it. He said, well, you know, it was on a conference call on phones. And he said, I was listening in, and we had to call the second pick. And they said, Lakers, you're on. You got 2 minutes. And Mr. Mose says, wait a minute, we need a little bit more time. And he said, we don't need any time. I knew. Oh, here's what happened was we had a kid at Tulsa University that played. He was on the track team. And the guy who he was from Minneapolis. And his dad worked for Mr. Short and did all the leg work and movement of taking the Minneapolis Lakers to L.A. So he did all the business stuff, all the contracts, you know, and everything. And so then he would, every article that came out, I had some great writers that were good friends of mine. I mean, really kind to me. And he And he would send those articles to his dad and say, he'd say, "Dad, give these to Mr. Short. He needs to know this guy. He can play. He can play in the NBA." Because he'd been watching the Lakers as a kid growing up and everything. So he knew kind of what they needed. And he was an athlete himself. He ran track. And so he didn't tell me he did that. And I didn't know it. He said, "Yeah," he said, "you know, what's his name? You knew the kid down there that was from Minneapolis." He said, "Well, you know, his dad worked for me." And he said, he would bring these articles to me and I'd read them. And I just decided that we need to get you on this team. And so he said he was sitting there on that second pick. And when they said, "Well, we're not quite ready." And he said, I just butted in. I said, "We're taking King from Tulsa." And he said, I heard from the other end, "Who the hell is King from Tulsa?" And he said, "I'm taking King from Tulsa. It's my damn team. You know, it's my team. I'm gonna draft King from Tulsa." And the old man said, "It'll be King from Tulsa." And that's the way I got drafted.
When you get there and then you're on the roster.
Yeah.
Tell us a little about, obviously, you've got two all-time great teammates. Just tell us a little bit about Jerry West, Elgin Baylor. Just give us an idea of what those guys were like day in, day out. Maybe a story about them. Just what separated them from just the average player in the NBA.
Jerry and I really hit it off. He was a country boy like I was, and you know, he didn't know anything but hard work. And actually, he and Elgin both set a great example, along with Rudy LaRusso, who was on the team, who was a great player. Those guys showed up every day. You know, they came and worked, and they didn't ask for any help, you know, any time off. They knew their job, and that set a great example for our team, and you had to respect them for that, you know. So Elgin could get a shot off, you know. He could get a shot off. He may not make it, but he could do contortion his body and everything, go up and hang and twist and, you know, put English on the ball and all kinds of stuff and get the shot off. But Jerry never took a bad shot. I don't remember him shooting a bad shot. He shot it when he wanted to, when he's ready. And he would, you know, he would get in the ball, and then we had centers that couldn't shoot a lick, but they could set good picks, and they'd come out and set a pick for him, and he'd rub his man off on them, on the big guys, and the big guys would switch off on him, and well, he'd just buckle their knees. I mean, he'd lower his shoulder and like he was going always to the basket, take one hard dribble, and he'd go up and just rip it. Never expected him to miss a shot. I mean, literally. He shot this shot. He never made a bad shot. He never took a bad shot. So everything seemed just supposed to go in. I saw him shoot. I would say he won. He would make 25 to maybe 30 shots to win games for us a year. I mean, out of the 82 games, he would, because when Dick Barnett was on the team when I first got there the first year, and Dick was a great shooter too. You know, he was an interesting player. I don't know if you remember him, but he was left-handed, and he would shoot up. He'd go up, kind of shoot off the side, off to his left. He didn't shoot straight in front of me, shot off to his left. And he would jump up and shoot that thing. And as soon as he left his hand, he'd say, "Fall back, baby." You know, it's in.
That's a quote that I don't know if you have you ever heard of the In Your Face basketball book?
Oh, yeah, I've heard it, but I never read it.
It's a great book. You would really enjoy it, but it has it's kind of about the culture of pickup basketball, but the Dick Barnett fall back is in that book.
Yeah, fall back, baby, he'd say. And so anyway, he would come in, and when I was a rookie, I didn't even really till you know a third of the game. I mean, half of the game. The games were played before I got started getting play. You know, I would because coach didn't believe in playing rookies unless they had to. And we'd go on into the, say the start the fourth quarter and we're down say 10 points, and Barnett would come in and he'd talk real deliberately slow, you know, like that and real low. And he'd say, "Looky here, man. Let's just keep it close." And I thought, yeah, let's keep it close. And, you know, I thought I knew what he was saying, but I didn't, because what he meant was, we'll keep it close, and then we'll start the move. We'll get every time down the floor. We'll give Jerry the ball. We'll, you know, send the big guy out to pick for him. He'll rub him off and buckle her knees, and he'll shoot it and make it. I don't care if he missed every shot the first three quarters. The last quarter, his eyes, like, dilated or something. You can just see that they're different. And then he just wouldn't miss it. He'd hit like, man, we just go ahead and play defense. And that was where I started playing, because I could play better defense than Dick, and I could play a little more depth. But anyway, and then when Hazard came on the team later, next year, he couldn't play a lick of defense. So he'd play some, but then I would get to play a lot of the defense, like for the fourth quarter especially. Dick Barnett was a fun guy to play around. And here's what Dick would do. He'd come down on the fast break, three on one, and he'd pull up at the top of the key. There was no three-point shots, you know. And he'd pull up and shoot it. And I'd hear him, "Fall back, baby." And I was in practice one day, and I wasn't about to, you know, say anything bad, but I asked Fred Schaus, I said, "Do you think 3-on-1 and a shot from the top of the key is better percentage than shooting a layup?" And he looked at me and kind of grinned, and he said, "Well, it's not for most people, but it is for Dick."
And in today's game, it definitely is.
Yes. Yes, I see that. But a lot of guys shoot it, and they don't shoot that good. They don't shoot as well as they should. But there's a lot of great shooters now.
Yeah, no question.
But anyway, Elton had the second year he got knee trouble, and that took him a long time to get him well. But he worked his tail off too. And the first time I went down on the floor, I was played with him. First time I went down the floor on the wing, the ball hit me in the face. I didn't even know where it came from. He was dribbling. He was leading the pack, and there was people between me and him. But he got it through there, and it hit me right in the face. And I realized I'm going to have to keep an eye on him if he's got the ball, because he was so strong, you know. And I used to be in my camp, I had a highlight reel. It's probably in 62, 63, because they played Celtics every year, you know, in the finals. And this time, you know how Bill Russell used to get the rebound, throw it out, and walk down to the offense, you know, back to the half court or so. He wouldn't run. And so he did that. He threw the ball out, and Elgin intercepted the ball about half court. And it just him and Bill just kind of backed up, just kind of scooted back, got in the lane and waited on him. And Elgin, and on this, I like to wore this, uh, this
film. I had it at my camp, and I'd show it to coaches and players and all that, and we just, everybody just couldn't believe it. But he left on his left foot on the free throw line, and he went up with the ball and kind of took it up in his left hand up high. And Russell left the floor and had his that big left hand up there waiting on him. And then he transferred the ball over to his right hand, and then he stuck his left arm out and got a hold of Bill's wrist and moved it over and slammed it right over him. It was one of the most incredible plays. You know, Elgin was really only about 6'5". You know, he wasn't 6'8", like some people thought. He's about 6'5". But, man, when he was young and had that spring, you know, I just saw a little bit, you know, one year of it. But he could do some things that you just wouldn't believe. And he also would do – I saw him one night in St. Louis. I saw him there. They didn't want – everybody knew he was going to go to his right on a dribble. You know, he's going to penetrate that way. Kind of like Lenny Wilkins, he was always going to go to his left. He might fake he's going to the right three or four times and still come back. You know? And that's the way Elgin was. You know, he might even walk over there. He might smooth his both feet, you know, 2 or 3 feet and try to get around somebody setting a pick, you know. And I mean, he'd cheat all the time like that. But Elgin, they forced him to go to his left. So he lowered his right shoulder, and he went to his left. And then he jumped up at about a 45-degree angle, and he put reverse spin on it. It was about 15 feet out. Reverse spin on it, where he shot it past the goal, and it came back, you know, back to the net.
Right.
And I'd never seen anybody do that. But he had our hands were pretty close to the same, except his was looked like he had an extra finger on there. They were so wide.
Yeah.
You know. So anyway, those two guys were great pros. I had nothing but respect for them for 3 years. And Jerry and I still are friends.
After you leave the Lakers, you end up in San Francisco with the Warriors, and you get an opportunity to play with Rick Barry, who historically is probably a player who I think there's a lot of sentiment out there that he's underrated. And then, of course, I'm sure you've heard the stories that he wasn't maybe all that well liked by players. So just what's your take on Rick Barry? Just give us your feeling about just what kind of player he was and what kind of teammate he was.
Well, you know, I liked Rick and I liked playing with him. He was, you know, if you were open and had a better shot than him, he'd get it to you. But he usually was going so fast that, you know, he was more open than anybody. You know, he could just fly down the floor, you know, and whoever's covering him couldn't go to the boards. You know, they'd have to start running, you know, getting back fast because he's going to come down the floor fast. And I never saw anybody take it to the basket as fast as he did. Like he could just beat you on the dribble and get past you. And, I mean, you know, get it to the basket so stinking fast. You know, it would take him about a second and a half to go from the wing to the net. And he had that great speed. And of course, you had Nate in there. He didn't have to go to the board, you know. Nate was as good as anybody under the boards. And, you know, shots and rebounds and stuff. And we had Clyde Lee, Clyde was about 6'11", and he was a great defensive player. So Rick, you know, Rick had some help from there. And then, but I'll tell you, Rick was, he was a prima donna, and he worked at it. He wanted to be. And, you know, he was the kind of guy we'd come in 2 o'clock in the morning and Bill Sharman, you know, Bill Sharman started that shoot around deal on day of the game. And so we always did that. And he would explain to us, give us 10 reasons why we need to shoot around at 10 o'clock in the morning or 11 o'clock and on the game day. And of course, Rick would say, he was leading the league in scoring, you know, at 36 a game. And he'd say, Bill, I need rest more than I need practice. Well, and you know, Rick and Bill would say, I know, Rick, I know that's how you feel. I know. But, you know, we're really playing together well right now. And it's just, you know, we need to stay together and do things together and, you know, just shoot and think together and, you know, be that kind of thing. Anyway, and I love Bill Sharman. I'd have played for him forever. And Rick, and he was very patient with Rick. But Rick, Bill had a rule that if you miss practice, or, you know, guys, if they were late for practice 1 minute, it cost them $1 a minute because they didn't leave early enough to get there. And then they'd run into traffic problems and he'd say, well, that's why you got to pay it for a minute. So it got him in better habits. Well, then Rick we came in at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning deal and he'd say, well, I'll see you guys in the morning. Rick would go over and get his checkbook and write the trainer a $25 check and said, I won't be there tomorrow. He just paid the $25 and sleep in. So, you know, we had a bunch of guys. For one, you had Al Addles and Jeff Mullins, myself, Clyde Lee, and Nate especially. Everybody was much more mature than Rick. And so when he would do the things, we'd just look at each other and kind of laugh and kind of smile and say, you know, that's Rick. And not think, you know, we wouldn't, you know, get upset or, you know, you just overlooked him because it's like you have a kid, you know, at home. And you just overlook what they get mad about doing. So, but he was a great scorer. Great score. Alex Hanna, when he coached him in San Francisco before he went to Philly and coached Wilt back there and got Wilt to start playing team ball instead of scoring 52 a game. Alex Hanna said one of these days he's going to play the whole game and score 50 or 60 and not miss a shot. And I thought that was kind of interesting because he looked like he could do that, you know, because he just didn't think he's ever going to miss sometimes. But he was a talented player, a very talented player. And but he wanted to argue about everything. Thought he knew a little bit, and he did. He knew a little bit about everything, but he wanted to
make sure everybody knew it.
Yes, that's exactly right.
you had an opportunity to play in the NBA Finals against both Bill Russell and Wilt Chamberlain. So somebody who's my age, 52, basically my recollection of those two guys as players comes from whatever highlight footage I can get and obviously reading and listening and watching as much as you can to study the history of the league. When you think about those two guys, just give us a compare and contrast your thoughts about sort of where they stack up in the history of the game. Obviously the most common argument is Wilt had all the statistics, wasn't always about winning. Russell didn't care about the statistics, was all about winning. Those are sort of the stereotypical descriptions of each of those guys. So just, are those things accurate? Are they inaccurate? Just tell us a little bit about your experiences with those two guys.
Oh, they're accurate. You're right on with them. Well, you know, I think Russell intimidated Bill. I mean, Russell intimidated Wilt. you know, he's only really 6'9", and he was like a big cat. You know, you couldn't outsmart him. He was really he studied the game, and he studied players. And, you know, I remember going in early in my career, my rookie year, and when I was playing against him, and went in down the middle, because I loved to drive the middle, and I'd go in and have my bottom, I'd hold the ball in one hand, and like I was going to just throw it up there. And I did that to Bill. Like, and he came up to block it. And I just, you know, instead, I just turned my hand over and threw it to our center, and he stuffed it. And I never did that again. Bill never forgot that. I mean, he would just back off and let me coast to the ground, you know, or else I had to jack it up there or try to find somebody to pass it to, and had to do that in about a second. So, you know, many times you throw it away when you do that. But anyway, Bill was a killer. He was like an assassin. And they used to say, the guys in whenever they get ready to play in the playoff games, you know, the big games, and Bill would get worked up on it and go in the shower and throw up before they went out. And the guys look around, look at each other, and pump their arm and say, "Yes." When he's doing that, they knew they weren't going to lose. You know, he's ready to eliminate everybody's inside shots. But on the other hand, I never felt Wilt's intimidation. I never felt his intensity like Wilt, like a Russell did. You know, Russell was he wanted to win really big time. And of course, all he had to do is see when he turned into the coach that he didn't win when he was a coach. He was only winning when he's playing. And anyway, Russell was limited in what he could do offensively, but that's not what his purpose was. He was a defensive genius, and I'll tell you something else that I've never understood why. I tried to teach. I had one big kid when I was coaching in Tulsa, and I tried to teach him. He was like 6'11", and I tried to teach him to not just jump up and slap it up in the seats. You know, Russell would jump up and tip it over. He'd tip it to one of his teammates, like Havlicek. Those guys would take off as soon as they saw Russell was going to block it. He never slapped it into the stands. That's not a possession. You know, it's out of bounds for the other team. So I never understood why coaches haven't taught a lot of these big guys how to not, you know, it's such a big deal for them to slap it up in the stands and all the fans go crazy. But that's not percentage basketball like Bill played. He would go up and tip it with his big left wrist. You know, he'd just use his hand. He wouldn't see him slap it at all with his arm. He'd go up as high as he could, then with his wrist, he'd go, tip, you know, knock it over to one of the players. And so, and Wilt never did that. You know, I don't think Wilt learned anything from him like that. It's where he wasn't looking to. I mean, I think Wilt realized he was twice as strong. He could have picked him up and stuffed him. He was so strong, you know. And Wilt was, you know, Al Addles used to tell me, he said, Wilt made him go to workout during the summertime. And he said he would go over there, and sometimes it would be some of those 49er guys in there, you know, lifting. And he said, I watched him do 550 on a bench press. He said it was not a stretch for him. And, you know, he said he tried to get Al to do stuff like that. And so Al said, I'm not going to do that. I don't need that. He, you know, Al's pretty strong anyway, but anyway, he was one of the strongest guys in the world. I know he was definitely a great athlete. He, you know, and one day in practice at San Francisco, this story was told me that before I got there, and they said Al was there, and they were talking about who the fastest guard, fastest player in the league was, and Wilt said, "I am," and of course nobody had ever seen him run full speed. You know, he never did that. I mean, I used to be in the middle of the court when he came down, and I'd have to move out of the way because he was like he was going to step on me, you right. know. And I was a midget to him, and so I'd just get out of the way so I'd stir him up, you know. But Al said he said, "Well, I don't know." Then they started throwing money out, you know, and saying, "Well, I'll give up a 20 on Al." All of them said, "Al's the fastest guy in the league, no doubt." And everybody believed that. And Wilt said, "Look, Al can start at the free throw line, and I'll start at the under the basket." And whenever you say start, and we'll run to the other in line and back to this line, and I'll beat him by 5 feet. And everybody was just screaming, you know, thinking that's idiotic. There's no way he can't move his feet that fast. He doesn't realize how fast Al is. And so they got out there and did it, and he beat Al 5 feet. Beat him a couple of strides, down and back. So that was his ability, but he never did show it very much. You know, he just didn't feel like he had to run all the time. Why should he run down the floor real fast? You know, it looked awkward. He looked awkward when he did that. But his makeup, his mental makeup was certainly not the same as Bill's. He didn't have to win. You know, he wanted to, I think, and he worked at the game. But he had to be motivated by personal gain. Like, you know, when he went after free throws, you know, I remember one of the things when they said, "You need to get the," Alex Hannon was saying, "Well, let's get, you know, percentages, let's get some of these, you need to show that you've played and you are a winner." He said, "One thing, you need to be the best rebounding, you have the best stats on rebounding." And of course that year, I think he averaged something like 28 or 30 rebound. That's like a team rebound number, you know?
Yep.
A lot of games had less than 30 rebounds. And Wilt was averaging that much a game just because he wanted to. And then one night we were playing, and Nate, you know, kind of grew up under Wilt, you know, because they drafted him, and then he got on the weights. I was in the All-Star games with Wilt and with Nate in college, and he was a stork. You know, he was like, he was 6'11", but he had little beady legs, and it looked like he was going to get them broken or something. So, and then, you know, he only weighed about 220. So he's really, really, you know, thin. And then the next thing I knew, Wilt had gotten him in the weight rooms, and he got up to 260. And that means he's got most of it on his shoulders and arms.
Yeah. Yeah.
This big, huge shoulders and arms. And his legs never got that much bigger, but, you know, Nate was he could block his shots. Like if he wanted to try to dump, use his dipper, you know, he couldn't use the dipper on Nate. He'd just go straight up and knock it back out. And we played him one game that when he was in that mode of trying to, he had 28 consecutive field goals. And he didn't take a shot the whole game because he knew Nate would get it.
That's funny. That's good stuff. That's good stuff.
It'd be nice to be able to, talk to Nate and not either one. I talked to Nate about it anyway, but I mean, Wilt, it'd be fun to just talk to him about it. But I don't think he wouldn't tell you anything anyway.
Yeah, he wouldn't tell you the truth probably in that case, right?
No, he wouldn't.
I always just think of Wilt as just an incredible athlete and the things that he did. And, and then you contrast that, as you did with Russell and just talked about how that mentality is such a big piece of, when you get to the NBA level, right? You're talking about the very best of the best, and everybody has talent and everybody has skill. And I think ultimately, and I don't care if you go back to the 60s and 70s when you were playing, or you talk about the modern NBA game today, what really sets apart the very, very best is that ability to be mentally tough and to separate yourself, not just with your skill and with your athleticism, because that's really hard to do because so many guys in the league have it. But that mental piece of it, I think, is incredibly important. And I think when you talk to people who were in that era when Russell and Wilt were going against each other, that was the advantage that Russell had, that his mind and the way that he utilized it to lift up his teammates and, as you said, sort of intimidate and kind of get into Wilt's head, gave him the advantage when it came to the two of them going head to head. And obviously Wilt had huge stats in those matchups, but Russell's teams usually got the best of them. And so someone who's not there, it's always interesting to read and to talk to someone like yourself who's there to kind of get that firsthand story of what it was like.
Yeah. Well, when I'm my rookie year, we went to Hawaii with three other teams. And so we'd go over there and play exhibition. And Jerry was kind of coaching me on, said if there'll be some fights. There's guys trying to make teams, there'll probably be some fights happen. So he said, if there's a fight, you need to go get a drink of water. He said, that's where I'll be. I'll be over at the water fountain. And sure enough, that big fight broke out. And I looked around and I went over to get a drink of water, and there Jerry was. He said, you can't let these guys slip up on you. They'll slip up on you, cold cock you. But anyway, Rudy LaRusso was a great player. I loved him. He was almost like a live cartoon. He had this great attitude. He was a Dartmouth graduate. He was very smart, and he put up with a lot. Then he'd just say, okay, I've had enough. And then he'd cold cock somebody, or let him know he's going to or something. He was just too cool. But anyway, we were playing, and I forgot even what team it was. There were three of us, other teams there, and we rotated. But we were playing against Wilt, and Rudy got mad at Wilt, they were jawing back and forth, and then finally I heard Rudy say, "You big son of a bitch, I'm not afraid of you, you big son of a bitch." And I thought, oh my gosh, And about that time, everybody realized there was going to be a fight, and so two guys grabbed Rudy and pulled him back, and two guys on each one of Wilt's arms, like were forwards, the forwards were like 6'8", 225, 230. And there's two on each of his arms. And they pull him out to half court, and he's standing right in half court. And I'm over there watching him, and I'm thinking, Rudy, just give it up, nobody wants to fight well. So finally,
they let Rudy go, and so he takes off running at Wilt, and Wilt's got these four guys. Well, two guys are kind of standing in front of him, and then each one of guys on his arm, and so he sees Rudy coming, and he just takes a step forward and extends his arms out and crosses them in front of him. And those two guys on his arms were like, well, it was like somebody like Don Nelson, you know, a big, strong two guys. And both of their feet came off the floor. And both of them crashed into Rudy and knocked him down. And Wilt says to him, I'm a big man, Rudy. Kind of low. And I thought, man, what an understatement. You know, here he's taking just through two guys at a total of about 500 pounds, and their feet came off the floor, and he threw them into Rudy as he was running into trying to get to Wilt, and he threw it and knocked him back. And then he's standing there looking at him, and he said, I'm a big man, Rudy. And that was, the fight was over.
Sort of an understatement by Wilt there, right?
Yeah, yeah, he didn't want to brag about it. He just said, I'm a big man, Rudy. And, you know, in other words, you better take note.
Yeah, absolutely. Just,
yeah, but anyway, that was one of those strongman deals he did one in that one game.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies. And most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Earlier in my career, there were more fights because there was no Players Association, and you didn't have any, you know, anything to pull them together. And I was in St. Louis next to Frank Selvey, my first year, and Cliff Hagan stepped out and hit. We had a guy on the team. I came to you. It was a guy who had been in the league a while, and he came off a pick. And Cliff stepped out and forearm shivered him in the mouth, knocked his teeth out. And I said, "Good grief! Why'd he do that? He didn't need to do that. There wasn't a fight going on. He just knocked him, cold cocked him." And Frank said, they had a fight a couple of years ago. He just got even. He said he just waited for the shot, you know, and that's what would go on then. And, you know, Luskatov at Boston, you know, he was on the bench for Red to protect him. And, you know, and when Elgin would get a hot hand, he'd put Luskatov in, who never played, but he'd rough Elgin up and try to get him in a fight, and then he'd throw both of them out. So it'd kill us to lose Elgin, but, you know, they could throw him out, and it didn't matter. But that was the kind of showboat went on then.
There you go.
They played all those games. Yeah.
Our mutual friend.
Answered your question.
Yeah, no, you did. Absolutely. So our mutual friend Tim Gallagher said that one of the players that I had to make sure that I asked you about was Jerry Sloan. And he said, make sure you don't just ask him about Jerry as a coach, which is how a lot of people remember him with the Jazz. But as a player, what I know of Jerry Sloan was that he was one of the toughest guys out there. So just, he said, make sure I ask you. So lay some Jerry Sloan on me.
Yeah, he was the hardest working basketball player that ever lived. I mean, he gave everything. He couldn't even dunk. You know, he was 6'5", but he couldn't dunk. He had little hands. He was a country guy, you know, country hands. I mean, he was
poor, and you know, he didn't have what you would call athletic talent as far as just, you know, gifted. He wasn't gifted. He outworked everybody. And I remember when Pistol Pete came in the league, and I was playing with Chicago then, and I came in to get, and I came in a little bit early, thinking, you know, there's gonna be a lot of people there tonight. I'm better get beat the crowd. And I came in, and Jerry was already dressed, and he's sitting in his locker room. And I said, "Man, when did you get here?" He said, "Oh, I got here a little while ago." And he was sitting there, all, you know, had his warm ups on, and he was ready. I mean, he would have gone to the airport to pick him up. You know, the papers had already made a big deal out of the best defensive player against the best offensive player, skilled offensive player against the skilled defensive player. They made a big deal in the splash of the paper. And so he would have gone after him at the airport if he could have. He wanted to pick him up as soon as he saw him. And in the first year, Pete never got double figures against him. What would happen, he really frustrated him, Jerry did. You know how you come down and you pass the ball to the wing, and you know you're going to go to the other wing or left. And as you go to the left, you keep looking over there, make sure your pass got to the right wing, right?
Right.
Well, everybody does that. And he had already studied Pete playing, and he saw that Pete did that a lot. And he had three fouls at halftime, charging fouls. Because Jerry, whenever time he made that pass on that side or either side, Jerry would be right up in his face. I mean, when he turned to go the other way, and he'd just pull him on top of him. And Pete got so rattled, really, he didn't know. He was afraid to run because he was afraid Jerry's going to do another one to him and foul him out or something. So he just completely took his game away from him with that kind of, you know, strategy. But I came in there to rookie camp, training camp, and we worked out at Wheaton College. And I got dressed. I walked out there, and I was shooting some free throws. And Jerry comes over, and he gets on the lane, he jumps in the lane real quick, like, he does that two or three times. I said, I thought he had lost his mind. I hadn't seen him all summer. And I said, "Mal, what are you doing?" And he said, "Didn't you hear they changed that rule?" I said, "What rule?" And he said, "Well, you know, you had to wait till it hit the rim before you could jump across." And he said, "Now, as soon as you shoot it, you can jump in the lane." He said, "I'm going to get some rebounds." You know, that was him. He was just he was just thinking any way he could get a possession, and he would get so beat up. You know, he'd take charges that he didn't care who it was. He and Norm Van Leer, he was the other guard because Jerry didn't really want to handle the ball, and Van Leer he was just like 6'1". And he would get hit. He would take one, jump out in front of a train. You know, he didn't care either. It must have been terrible playing against our team. But every 4 to 6 weeks, Van Leer had to go get these. He had these big hanging balls on his elbows. He'd land on his elbows when he'd get charges. And then so they'd swell up, you know, and get blood and get, you know, they'd have to drain them every so often. But Jerry was big enough to where he could kind of hold his own, you know, because his body was bigger. But he still took a beating. His body looked like he'd get him in the shower. Every time he'd go in the shower and I'd see him, I'd think he looked like he's about 75 years old. His body is. And that was when he was pretty young.
Yeah, you're still young at that point, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's probably about 32 then. But no, I loved him for what he was. You know, he gave everything he did, everything he could to make his team win, and he would give it all up. Just nobody outworked him. You know, nobody got ahead of him there. He would come to my camp in the summertime and get out there with the kids and start teaching them about taking charges, and he'd take charges on them. They'd be landing on top of him, and, you know, he'd get up and he'd say, "Get up, get up, get up, get up." You know, he'd teach them how to take charges where they wouldn't get hurt. So he was a good guy. He was an awesome good guy. Yeah. I could talk about him for a long time.
Yeah, I believe it. I mean, it's amazing just when you go back and talking to a guy like yourself, and as somebody who, even growing up as a kid, so again, I'm 52, yeah. So born in 1970, and growing up and reading about some of the guys that you obviously had the opportunity to play against, and thinking about the history of the game, and it's always an honor to be able to talk to somebody who actually suited up with some of the guys that you get an opportunity to read about and hear about, and obviously never got to see those players or yourself play live, but the stories still live on, and I think it's such an important part of the game of basketball. And you think about the history of where it's been and how it continues to evolve. And I'm sure there's times where you sit back and watch a game today, and obviously there's still lots of elements of the game that are the same, but I know even from the time when I played college basketball, like, things are just so different in terms of the way the spacing is and just the skill mm-hmm. level of the players is just so much better. When you sit and watch a game today, what thoughts pop into your mind as you're watching, whether it's
college games? I'll tell you the mystery to me. I mean, it's not a mystery, but I think it's a mystery to a lot of other people, is that you got a guy like Westbrook who is talented. You know, he's got great skills, basketball skills. He's got speed, quickness, strength. And yet he doesn't fit in anybody's plans, anybody's game,
right?
Because he can't. He was a kid that probably grew up on, you know, on the streets in L.A. And nobody, you know, he never was a point guard anyway,
right?
You know, they made him a shooting guard when he was in college. So then now they're wanting him to be a point guard, and he doesn't have the smarts to do that.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
I mean, it's not all that, but I'm not putting him down. I'm just saying he doesn't have he's a reactor. He's not a thinker.
Yep.
And that's the way Norm Van Leer was with the Chicago Bulls. And I used to talk to Mata about it. I was an assistant to Mata there, and we would talk about it. I'd say, you know, he's a reactor, so he's never going to think. You know, he's never going to think like you want him to. He's just going to react to whatever happens.
Yep. He's not thinking ahead.
He'll make something happen. He'll make it happen, but it may be wrong.
Who in the modern game, what players do you enjoy watching today?
Well, Steph's my favorite. He plays so unselfishly. You know, the Warriors are the best team to watch if you want to watch team play and hard work and you know, unselfishness. So much easier to play that way rather than I can't believe KD's not going back to, you know, saying, "Send me back to San Francisco."
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. It's kind of crazy he wanted to leave in the first place.
Well, really. But, you know, they think the money is everything. So you have to be smart enough to get what you can, but without screwing up people's lives.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Especially your own.
No question.
You know, so I wonder if KD, if I could talk to KD, I would ask him, you know, what do you think about it now? Would you do it again? You know, how important is the money?
But, and the winning. Know, I mean, right? It's a balance between, and the money is so big in the game today. I mean, the numbers in normal people, we can't even relate to the amount of money, the size of the contracts. It just, at a certain point, it just becomes kind of ridiculous. But you look at what drives guys to make the decisions that they do. And I think goes back to what I said earlier. I think the very best players, they have something that separates them. And part of that is just that they value winning. Now, they don't always make the best decisions about how to go about getting to that winning situation. But I think those the best guys, I mean, Steph's a great example of, like, as a Cavs fan, you know, obviously I went through a stretch where I didn't enjoy watching him very much, just from a selfish standpoint. But prior to the Cavs Warriors finals runs, Steph was definitely a guy that you just, as a basketball player, if you're trying to watch somebody that you can just appreciate all the things that he does that so many players just don't do, and his off-ball movement and his footwork and the things that he can do that the average person just doesn't notice or is not picking up on. He's so good at all those little small things that add up to be one big giant thing. He's so unique. There's nobody that plays the game like him. And that just discounts the fact that he's the greatest shooter in the history of the game. There's so many things that are fun about him beyond just his ability to shoot the ball.
His love for the game is just bulges out of him.
Yep.
He loves the game, and that makes it fun. You know, because he's got a smile on his face all the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's other guys who think they got to be bad to play, I guess.
Yeah.
Westbrook, I think, is lost. You know, I just don't. Another kid is really, I think, really needs help is Simmons, left-hander.
We've talked about him a lot, Jim, on the podcast, and he was a guy who, back there early in his career, I kind of had him pegged, and my partner Jason, who isn't on with us tonight, but he and I kind of debated back and forth, you know, between would you take Simmons or would you take Embiid if you had to take one of them. And for a while early on, I was like, I think you take Simmons. To me, he's more versatile, and Embiid had the injury history and the just felt like he was never in great shape, and it just felt like Simmons was a guy that, you know, played both ends of the floor and did everything. But I think when you look at what happened to him, I think slowly at first and then very, very quickly, where when you get that mental block, when you get the yips at the free throw line, it's really hard. I think people discount how hard it is to overcome that when you're afraid to go out there and play and go to the free throw line because you don't want to go up there and have to shoot free throws. And I worry that guy that we saw early in his career is gone because he just can't get over that mental piece of it to be able to take advantage of all the skills that he has. It's painful to watch, in all honesty.
It is. It is very hard because you can see him struggling and you can see he just doesn't want to go up there.
Right.
Yeah. He really doesn't want to go to the free throw line. If I had his address, I'd write it. I would go up there, and you know, I feel like one thing I learned to do from Sharman. Sharman was a great, you know, he had the free throw percentage record forever, like it's 95% shooting, and he would concentrate. But he had a book called Five Steps to Shooting, and I went to a clinic with him one time when I was still with the Lakers, and he was working there for Tidewater Oil Company, and he was doing clinics and stuff. And I went to watch him, and he spoke about these five steps to to shooting, and I had never in my life, in those days, it was just jump shots were new, you know.
Right, right.
Like late 50s, there were still a lot of guys shooting two-hand shots, you know. But I watched him, I got so excited. I came back and got in a gym as soon as I could get in. I don't know if it was the next day or that night, but I didn't know what I was doing. I had these big hands. I'd jump up like I was going to shoot a jump shot, and then I'd dump it, you know, kick it off because I'd look like I was going to shoot it, or I'd hang on to it and shoot. Finally, when I started down, I'd shoot it. But it was goofy because it messed my shot up.
Right.
And so Bill told me about, he said, you have to either shoot it or pass it. Try to do both. And so if you're going to leave the ground, shoot it, you know, don't pass it. I went in the gym and I started shooting one-handed, over and over and over. And he's told me how to, you know, you got to come off these two fingers and everything is going to be straight. And it's like, you know, how you line it up. And he just, and you know what? My grandson, he worked with me on Dallas when I was living down there. Turned into a really great shooter because I worked with him quite a bit, told him this, you know, this five steps. And he was looking at some of my basketball cards, and they put those percentages back there. You know, he said, Pop King, did you realize when you left the Lakers what your shooting percentage was? And so I know it was bad. I don't remember. I didn't want to know, but I said it was bad because I didn't shoot that much.
Right.
You know, because the coach would say, let's get the ball to the shooters. If you miss, if you took a shot, you know, he'd say, let's get the ball to the shooters. Well, what do you, you know, you, I averaged 20 a game in Missouri Valley Conference. You know, I could shoot. I got a lot of it going to the basket because I could get to the basket, but, you know, I wasn't going to argue with him. But anyway, I didn't have anybody teach me how to shoot until I heard that from Charmin. And then, of course, I was running camps for years. And I would start teaching kids and telling them. And I mean, it was just incredible how you could turn them around, you know, just by simply working with them for an hour and give them the right way to do it. And then they can learn to shoot it straight. You know, you got to learn to shoot it straight before you can make anything. You got to be able to shoot every shot straight. And that's what. And then I studied guys that were great shooters when I was playing, like Oscar and West, and you know, all the guys that were. You know, Jerry Lucas was a great shooter. And, you know, all the guys that were considered great shooters, I would try to cover them or get around them and talk to them about their shot. Anyway, I know I could. When I saw him the other day, last week, and when he started walking up to the free throw line, I said, he doesn't want to be there. I know he does. That feeling.
Yeah.
But if I could spend a few private time with him, you know, for an hour or a couple of hours, I guarantee I could have him walk up and you know, lock everything out and shoot. Even if it's just used one hand. Because it has to be a one-hand shot.
Right.
Right now he's doing a one and a half or one and a quarter hand.
Right.
You know, he doesn't even know what he's doing. And I know that's true.
Or you get him to shoot like Rick Barry, right?
Well, that's hard to teach.
Yeah.
Wilt tried that, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he had success, right? His 100-point game, shot him underhand and went 28 for 32.
Yeah. But did he keep doing it?
Didn't keep doing it. Didn't stick with it. Didn't want to look wimpy, right?
I know. Yeah. He didn't. He probably thought it was silly or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But he had, you know, just think if he had had that kind of shooting percentage.
Right. How many more points he would have scored? I mean, it would have been ridiculous. Oh, I mean,
my
crazy.
Gosh.
Yeah.
He probably crazy. Had more 100 point games, you know.
Yeah. 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 No question about that.
Anyway,
Jim, we are coming up to 2 hours, and
oh my God,
this has been just a blast for me to be able to hear your stories and the experiences that you've had in your lifetime and in your career. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on and to join us.
Sure.
And I'm thankful too. Thankful for our friend Tim Gallagher for connecting us and putting this together.
He's a good man.
Again, I just want to say thanks and really appreciate it. And to everyone out there who's part of our audience, we thank you for listening and we'll catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.